Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and thank you so much for joining us as we come your way every week at on richarddugan.com. We stream live as well as at newspress.com. We are rebroadcast on A2Zen.fm on Sundays at 3 p.m., and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show page. I had to double check that because there is no S at the end of that. If you're looking for the radio shows page, it's radio show with one S, show. So please check out all of our stuff. We'd love to hear from you as well. My email address, richard@richarddugan.com. That's richard@richarddugan.com. And if you would like to help out with the work that we're doing here, go to the mission page and read what we are all about. If you don't know, if you already do know and you'd like to support us, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and do what you can. I have a question for you that leads us into our guest for today, and I think that it's highly appropriate. So let me ask you, what do these items have in common? Baseball, birthdays, getting up and going to work, and for that matter, this radio program. They all contain or have built into them, whether we are conscious of it or not, rituals. Really? Yes, rituals. The Joy of Rituals is the title of the book. Barbara Bijou is my guest, Spiritual Recipes to Celebrate Milestones. And we are looking forward to talking with her about this. Barbara, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, as I was musing about this just the other day, thinking about this program, because I am more than just a big fan of rituals, of ceremony and tradition, I began to realize that most every facet of our life can be considered a ritual, especially if it's something that we have been doing over and over again for who knows how long. For those going to school, you know, you get up and you get yourself ready to go and you take the bus or bike or walk or however you get there and you go through the day, go from one class to the next. There is a certain element of ritual in that. I know that's part of what we're going to talk about, but also I have to say that I've been through both the very formal ritual, marriage ceremony, and also the very informal ritual of the marriage ceremony. As much as I love, and I was born and raised in the Catholic Church, which is steeped in ritual and tradition and ceremony and symbolism, I have to say that I really enjoyed the non-traditional, self-created. My wife and I basically created that ceremony that we both participated in, that we had family and friends in our backyard, and we made everything, we set everything up. I built this beautiful arch made out of cypress branches and on and on and on. But a lot of people don't seem to realize that that's part of their lives. But even more importantly, and this is, I think, where we want to begin, we don't realize just how important and vital they are to our civilization.
Absolutely. I totally believe that.
Well, tell us about this book with the Joy of Ritual that you've put together. And I guess maybe we'll go ahead and start from the point of why.
Well, the reason I did it is because I had a very profound personal experience with ritual that literally changed my perspective. It's almost like I was cracked open to my divine potential. I mean, I know that sounds a little pretentious, but it was really true. When I was in a retreat many years ago in Arizona, I was in silence and fasting, and as I walked around, all this stuff started to bubble up, and I knew that something was going on, but I didn't know what it was. And when I started to tune in and meditate, I realized that I had stuffed down years of real grief that I had never really experienced and really grieved, quote, properly, because I had lost my sister. She was only 24 when she died, and I was pregnant. And it was just too traumatic for me at that age, and I stuffed it down. But years later, it all bubbled up. and I needed to do something and found myself, just like you created your own wedding ritual for yourself and your wife, I had to create some kind of a ritual that would let me express what I was feeling. And it had to be truly ritualized. It wasn't enough for me just to feel it. So we talked about this before, and I wound up walking until I found this big tree and got down on my hands and knees, literally digging in the dirt, rocking, crying until I dug this hole. And it was like I filled the hole. I gave my grief to Mother Earth, and I covered it up, and I just did a prayer. And I remember, I think I even had a little sage with me, and I sprinkled it on, and something totally changed. And I knew from that moment something profound had happened. And days later, when I could talk again because our silence was over and I shared with people, I found out that I did a Native American grief ritual. And as even part of it, the rocking that I did, digging in the sand and the earth, comes from ancient Mesopotamia. And it was a movement people did even then, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, to release grief from their body. So all of these aspects came to me, and I was like, whoa. You know, traditional rituals, if they work, are fabulous, but there's a lot of stuff out there that we don't have rituals for, and I know that it can help people in transitions, and that's really why I wrote the book, to give people information, because people wanted to know. They kept asking me.
So let's maybe define a little bit more so. I've given lots of examples, but I haven't really defined. Mm-hmm. What is, and do I say what is ritual or what is a ritual? Is there a difference?
You know, for me, the act of the word ritual means to fit together. That's really the root word for it. So I suppose it could be either. And yet, to me, it's a way of honoring life's passages, whatever they are, whether they're happy, whether they're sad. You know, it's, as you said, starting a new school, getting married, releasing grief, having a baby. It doesn't matter. It's a way of honoring life's passages, and it moves you from one level of consciousness to another. So it's directly inputted into the brain in a way that you don't have to even start analyzing it. It just goes in. It's like a B12 shot. Boom, there you are, and something is different.
Mm.
I mean, in your experience of creating your own ritual for yourself, I mean, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I'm assuming from what you said, it was very meaningful that you actually created something that moved you into a new state of being with your partner, so that it was a sacred union.
Indeed. And I know, too, that it is possible for us to sometimes get lost in ritual. In other words, we tend to forget what we're creating the ritual for, but we go a little bit overboard. And that's what I see happening in a lot of the more traditional weddings. They get lost in with the color of the bridesmaids' gowns and what are the men going to wear,
right,
and the cake,
right,
and the flowers. And I mean, you've seen Bridezilla, those television programs where they show those kinds of things. And it's like,
yeah,
you've lost the sheer meaning, the true meaning of the ritual of joining together, of becoming one.
Absolutely. I mean, just like you said, I bet most people don't even know what something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue even means.
Yeah.
And how many thousands and thousands and thousands of brides do it.
Yeah.
You know, they have no idea that it comes from a sacred, you know, meaning of something old is your ancestors, where you came from, your lineage. Something new is this new bond you're creating. Something borrowed actually has to do with an old fertility ritual where you'd borrow something from the most fertile person in your town. You know, so watch out, people, with that something borrowed, you know, unless you're setting intention for creative projects. And then something blue represented the divine, the feminine face of God, so to speak, bringing in that goddess, bringing in, you know, something. Because early, you know, weddings weren't even spiritual.
Yeah.
It had to do with, okay, you have this amount of money, I have this, I'm going to give you babies, you know,
right.
Or let's stop a war. It had nothing to do with spiritual and love. It had to do with clans coming together and safety and security. It's very different.
Yeah.
I mean, it still happens today, but...
Even in the pioneer days, you got married to have children to be able
exactly.
to run the farm, you know?
Exactly.
To be able...
It wasn't about true love.
Yeah, which to me seems a little backwards because if there are only two of you, okay, to
mm-hmm.
feed, granted there are only two of you to work... But if you add more mouths to feed, now you got to work even harder. Oh, yes, these children will, they'll work in the field, but they can't start right away. They don't drop out of the womb and
right.
start picking the corn.
Right.
So it's very interesting. And now, I used a couple of things in my list. One of them, because I have no specific allegiance to team, but I love the game of baseball. And that the game of baseball isn't played anywhere else but between the white lines in the diamond. That's where
right.
the game is played. And you have the ritual of preparing the field. Now, I don't see it as a field of combat, but more as a place of, shall we say, mental more so than physical competition. And there is more thought, more mind that goes into it. And so you have to prepare yourself. And, of course, a lot of players, they have many rituals. They may call them superstitions before a game, depending upon the type of game it is. If it's postseason, some guys they won't shave for the entire playoff series. Even if it takes them to the World Series, they're not going to shave until. That's one of their rituals or superstitions. I mean, you have all of this, especially in the world of sports with guys. I don't know how many women.
Do.
I don't know how many women do that in sports.
Do that in sports? It would be very interesting. I'm sure that, you know, women tennis players or different athletes have different rituals to prepare for going to the Olympics or being in sports. I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine, David Megacy, who's an ex-football player, NFL guy, and he was talking about all the rituals and how we need to create new rituals that aren't just about let's go kill these people, because, you know, he's talking football.
Yeah.
But they are rituals of camaraderie, though, on many levels when you have these team sports. You know, they come together as a unit. So that, yes, it's individual competition, but it's also team. We want our team to win, not just the individual.
Right.
So it's an interesting coming together as a community that the rituals have. People who go to the ballpark.
Exactly.
You know, look at the old songs, you know, buy me some peanuts and pop, you know, whatever that is.
Yeah, Cracker Jacks.
You know, there's certain foods, I bet. What do you eat when you go to a baseball game? Anything special? For you, for your ritual?
As far as baseball is concerned?
Yeah, baseball. I mean, if you went to a game, is there a ritual as a spectator that you participate in?
I listen more on radio and television. I've only been to a few games. I was fortunate to grow up in a town that became not only a baseball town, but also a World Series town, and that was Phoenix, Arizona. And I mean, I was growing up hoping, I was a Dodger fan for the longest time because that's what we listened to there in Phoenix on the
right.
News Talk sports station. And then when the Diamondbacks came to town in, I think it was 98, I thought, oh, this is great. At least we have a major league team. But I mean, it's going to be years before we ever get to the playoffs. And then we were in the playoffs for like 2 or 3 years. And I thought, oh, that's great. But you know, no way. I mean, with the Yankees and the Dodgers and all these, never go to the World Series. And I'm 4 years later, we're there. And we're winning, and we win it, and it's like, wow. So my experiences with baseball as far as ritual are more internal as the game progresses. We, on this station, we broadcast the local university, Southern California University baseball games, and I love listening to the games and the play-by-play. I mean, the announcer's fine. I enjoy listening to him, too, but it's not so much him as much as as he's calling the play and just imagining and seeing in my mind's eye what's happening and then wondering, all right, so now every play has stopped. Now what are we going to do? And it's that mental gymnastics, if you will, because you don't, there's no way to predict in any given
right.
play what is going to happen. And that is what, and granted, that's true with the others, but I don't know, there's just something, it's the pace of baseball that I love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a flurry and then a pause, and a flurry and a pause. Mm-hmm. And you get that moment of retrospection, if you will. And if I were the pitcher, and I'm in a particular count, and there are so many runs that we're behind or ahead, and, you know, how am I feeling out there? Am I going to just push all this other stuff away and just say, you know, I'm just out here pitching. I'm just out here pitching, having a good time, playing a game. I mean, my God, I'm an adult playing a game, and I'm getting paid to do it, you know, whatever. That's kind of where I am at as far as the ritual is concerned, of being the observer. And I thought about, as you mentioned, the community. I thought of the tribe, watching the competition, watching the sport as it unfolds, and they rise and fall with each flurry. And of course, different parts of the tribe are rooting for one side or the other. But
right.
it's not about, okay, and if we win and you lose, then your team dies. You know, mm-hmm. it's just you. We win.
But it's health. It's healthy competition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a sense of healthy wholesomeness to that part of it. And it is a connection. It connects you to your friends. It connects you to other people who belong to, you know, root for the same team. It connects you to the whole bigger picture, which a lot of rituals, you know, that's their purpose, is to connect you, to be connectors, so you don't feel so isolated. And I think a lot of team sports do that. They connect people. They feel part of something. That's why they buy the jackets and the hats and, you know, they identify themselves with a certain collective.
But then again, that ritual does tend to go to an extreme where we have had mm-hmm. situations in different sports around the world, for that matter, where that's where the term fan comes from, fanatic. They go just a little overboard, and it's like, it's just
yes.
a sport, folks. Come on, you know?
Exactly. Just, I'm with you on that
yeah.
one.
But then again, it's not the only place, because we have, obviously, rituals in our various belief systems, in our religions.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, you know, being born and raised Catholic, I mean, there's just something, and it's interesting because I am not a practicing Catholic, but I still lean in that direction, and I'm grateful to my mother for not doing things that others did to force me to attend Mass in my teen years. And it was explained later, the reason was because I didn't want you to push away from the church, and I didn't. I never left the church. I just stopped practicing, so to speak, you know. It's like I don't play the violin
right.
either anymore because I stopped practicing. But that doesn't mean I don't like the violin. But those kinds of rituals within our spiritual life, tell us about that level of enrichment, if you will.
Well, you know, even thinking about Mother's Day when you just said that,
mm-hmm.
you know, the original Mother's Day, not the one that was invented here in America, was you would go back to your mother church. That's what it was really about, where people were leaving their villages to go work in other places. One day a year, they came back to their mother church to connect again, to get, as I said, like a booster.
Huh.
So true. The rituals that really have that juice, because to me there's rote rituals and there's really alive rituals, and you could feel the difference, give you such a deep connection that you have resources, and I think that's really crucial. It's not about, you know, we're right, you're wrong, this is the only way to do it, but you get fed. It's spiritual nourishment. So that when you, whether you're going to church or temple or you're outside or whatever, you're listening to the music that reminds you or participating in the sacred ritual, you get plugged in. And especially when there are old rituals that have been going on for a long time, you can feel the connection to the ancestors, which is why so many cultures around the world have ancestor worship. We're one of the few that don't, actually. Most cultures around the world do many things where they connect themselves to the ancestors because they feel it feeds them and they feel the ancestors. There's reciprocity. So they're anchors. They really anchor us to something larger than we are. And I always say, you know, without it, it's like having a body without a backbone. They connect us to source, and they allow us to take more risks. They allow us to be more creative because we have a connection, and that's really important.
I want to talk, when we come back from our break, about a ritual that is truly overlooked in our society today in the West. And it has to do with both sexes. And we're going to talk more about that as we talk more with Barbara Bijou, the author of The Joy of Ritual, Spiritual Recipes to Celebrate Milestones, East Translations and Ease Transitions, and to Make Every Day Sacred. And we're going to talk more with Barbara here in just a moment as we continue on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Don't go away.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. My guest, Barbara Bijou. She's the author of The Joy of Ritual, one of my favorite subjects, along with several others, but I would put this right near the top anyway. Barbara, the subject I want to talk about now has to do with something that I struggled with. I struggled with for the longest time. I'd have to say probably even after the age of 33, which to me was rather significant because up to that point, I'd been wondering, and even after that, I would ask this question having to do with rituals. When does the male of the species become a man? And when does the female of the species become a woman? Now, I ran down this long list of things. Is it at the age of 16 when he gets his driver's license? Or the age of 18 when he gets to vote? Or 21 when he gets to drink? Or when he has his first sexual experience? Or when he gets married? Or gets his first job? And the list goes on. Now, for me, as much as I'd like to say, yeah, when I turned 18 or 19 or 21, I was a man. I had hair on my chest and blah, blah, blah. I could grow a beard now. I'm a man because I can grow a beard. Yeah, right. But it was when I was 33 and I was on a camping trip and a gentleman that I was camping with, actually two buddies of mine were camping, but this one gentleman and I went up first to set up camp and so forth. And it became so tense. I grew up in a family of eight, and I knew how to wash dishes. As a matter of fact, we were given a week at a time where two of us were chosen each week. One would set the table, the other one would wash the dishes. We may have had an electric dishwasher, but we didn't use it very often. So there I am on this camping trip, and he's trying to tell me how to wash dishes. And this obviously was the straw for me. It had been building. And I finally just blew up and I walked away. I walked up the hill, said, I'm not dealing with this. And he comes up the hill and he says, hey, you brought up my PTSD. You know, he was a Vietnam vet. And I basically at that point where I was, I don't care. I says, you're not my father and you're not my professor. We were supposed to come up here and have a good time. And it was the first time that I actually stood up for myself. It wasn't that I was attacking him. It was that I was standing up for me for the first time that I could remember. Now, I remember sharing this with my mother and at dinner one evening, and I remember saying that, yeah, I remember age 33, I felt like I'd become a man. And she says, well, it's about time.
Love your mother.
But we don't have those rituals. In the Jewish tradition, the males have a bar mitzvah. Now, in the old world, when you became 13 and you had your bar mitzvah, they treated you like a man.
Absolutely.
But not today. Not in the new world.
No.
So tell me about how we, as men and women, you and I, how do we know when we've reached that milestone? What ritual can we pull on reach for, hook to.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought this up because I'm passionate about this. We do not have rituals where people become men and women like they used to. And a lot of people now are trying to bring in, you know, puberty rituals for boys and for girls. However, because it's really not of their culture, most of them, it doesn't kind of set in. The key, and you hit the key as far as I'm concerned, it's when you start to take on more responsibility and you're given more freedom and you are treated differently. And we do not treat people differently in this culture depending on where you live. So, for example, I mean, you could go to the Army at 18, but you can't legally drink. That makes no sense. You know, I mean, are you not a man if you can go and kill somebody? I don't think there's a real answer. The one suggestion that I like to have and do is that as you get older and older, you know, from children, if you're parents, you need to start to do yearly rituals where every year your child takes on more responsibility and is given more freedom so that by the time they're 18, 19, 20, they've already gradually taken on, you know, their, quote, manhood or womanhood, you know, because otherwise we all know that there are 50-year-old babies out there who have never grown up because no one ever gave them that, you know, paradigm, that no one ever gave them that experience. So they're treated like children. They're not treated differently. So we have to really revamp our education system, and we need to, as parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles, really look at how we treat children, because if we're always doing everything for them, they're not going to grow up. And it's no longer about, it used to be that 12 and, you know, 12 is for a girl, by the way, in Judaism, and 13 is a boy. It had to do with when you could literally have children and puberty. And many cultures around the world have the same thing. You know, in the days when you would have children very early, which they would, and, you know, propagate the tribe, then you were a man, you were a woman, but you had to go through initiation rites. You had to go through different trials, especially the boys. Girls were always considered to be more connected to spirit than boys, which is kind of interesting. So they had to work at it a little harder. But, yeah, I think we need a movement for this. You hit something that's so, so important to our whole civilization.
Well, I think, too, there's another aspect to this, too, because, and you brought this up, that when I have been talking with people about this subject, as a matter of fact, I had a men's group that I shared facilitation with another gentleman, and this was back in 93, and it actually ties in a little bit to the sports as well, because that was the year that our basketball team in Phoenix, the Suns, went up against the Bulls and missed it by that much once again, as far as the Game 7, you know, and so forth. But again, another one of those wonderful rituals of participating vicariously through the players. But I wanted to have a men's group. I wanted to get together with guys. And I remember part of the impetus, interestingly enough, was because of a comedian by the name of Tim Allen, who at that time was doing this bit about men. And his phrasing was, you know, men are pigs, you know. And you know, a lot of people accused him of being anti-woman, when in fact the reality was he was actually more anti-woman than you could realize, because what he was advocating was that guys need to spend time with guys. I mean, you hear about girls' night out all the time. Well, what about guys' night out? You know, and we're not talking about going out and getting yourself smashed. We're talking about spending some quality time in a group of guys talking about what's real for them, what's important to them. And I would venture there are some guys that are listening now that are saying, yeah, I wish I had a group like that. I mean, you know, yeah, I do go out and I have a few brews and that kind of stuff with some friends of mine, but I really would like to have the opportunity to sit and talk with some guys about some things that are really important to me. I mean, my marriage is important to me, but I got some issues. My job is important to me, but I got some issues I'm trying to resolve, and I can't seem to grasp the solutions, you know, or just.
And did you, how long was your men's group?
It lasted about a year. One of the aspects of it, though, was that we decided that, and by the way, our primer was Iron John by Robert Bly.
Yes. Right.
And which is usually most, and I think one of the parts of it that we read about, of course, was the catabasis, that mm-hmm. bottoming out, that people need to do in general, but men in particular, in order to start working your way back up from the bottom. And so what we decided to do, we wanted to make these gatherings more profound, if you will, more important, more significant. So we started going hiking in the mountains around Phoenix. And the most profound hike that we took was out to the west to what were called the Bradshaw Mountains. I think that was the incorrect name we found out later, in the middle of a rainstorm. And we had our hiking sticks and we had our ponchos and we had our hats and we went hiking in the pouring rain, walked up the face of a waterfall to the top, walked around and so forth. We came back down, went back to one of the guys' houses where his girlfriend made a nice hot lunch. I mean, we were soaked to the skin, so we were able to dry out and so on and so forth. But I mean, it was like at one point the rain didn't matter anymore because you were as wet as you were going to get. So it didn't matter anymore that the stream that we had crossed ankle high was now waist high, and that we were just having the greatest time. And we would have conversations about stuff that was going on in our lives. And by the way, I was the only married guy at the time. Shortly thereafter, I divorced. But
uh-oh.
Yes, but I've since
well.
Yes, but I've since found another woman who has been just incredible. But I seem to be connecting a lot with guys here in Santa Barbara, and even
and
interviews.
It's so important. It's
yeah.
So important.
Yeah.
You know, even in Iron John, he talks about, you know, the boy needs to literally, it's like they steal the fire, you know, in the mythology of Prometheus and stealing the fire. So in one sense, the boy has to radically break from the mother. To when you asked about being a man,
yeah,
and mothers need to understand this too. They can't baby. There's a certain stage where you can't baby your son anymore, and it's hard to let go. I'm a mother of a son. Trust me, I know this. But I'll tell you about my ritual. I don't even know if my son knows this. There was a point where he was going, you know, when he went off to college or whatever. I just felt we were too close. Because, you know, I was a single mother. I adore him. Where he was, you know, like everything for me. He was my prince, whatever. And I said, you know, this isn't really healthy. I need to really be able to let him go. So I created, and another friend of mine had the same thing with her son. She felt they were too close, and we couldn't separate. And he had to separate to become his own person. So I went out, and we did it together. We bought some rubber tubing. And we created a ritual. We literally symbolically cut the umbilical cord. And in the ritual, we let our sons go to be men and to experience who they were. And, I mean, I'm giving you the short version. And right after that, my son got his first job and moved to Texas.
Mm.
And I know that energetically he felt – I never told him I did this. So energetically – you know, he felt the release that he could go off because mothers need to learn to do this with their children. Fathers need to do it with their daughters. And it's not that you ever close down your heart because you're not closing your heart. Your heart is always connected to your child and you always want the best for them. But energetically, you had to let them go and make their own mistakes and go on their own path. You know, a friend of mine who's from South Africa, who's Zulu, said to me, you know, we walk on our path of life all the time. People come, they walk with us for minutes, for days, for years, for lifetimes. Sometimes they walk for years, they leave, they come back. But you always have to remember it's your path. Mm. And that really struck in my head because talk about Zulu and rituals and, you know, initiation. He actually carved an initiation drum for my son when my son was a teenager.
Wow.
He had to cut down. He cut down a tree and made a special boys' drum that they give the boys in their ceremonies.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
pretty
cool
awesome.
Stuff. That's cool stuff.
Yeah,
I remember trying to become a member of different groups when I was a kid growing up. I tried to become a member of the Scouts. I entered as a tenderfoot, and 6 months later, I left as a tenderfoot because that particular – I'm not sure exactly what happened, but it didn't fit for me the way that I had hoped that it would. I joined band in high school, and I joined a singing group, Madrigals, in high school, which was great fun. And there was a certain level of camaraderie, if you will, amongst the males, but they had their cliques, even the guys that were there, the seniors. I was still, I think, a sophomore or junior. But it was still a lot of fun and what have you. And I've continued to try to do that throughout my life. And of course, with that men's group, it was a wonderful thing. And I think that maybe what we might want to talk about a little bit now might have to do with talking about some specifics. First of all, I think that to me is one of the most fabulous elements when one person receives from another a gift that was created especially for them. And I mean created, not bought in a store, but I mean built. That's one of the reasons why when my second wife and I married and we had our non-traditional ceremony, I built an arch out of eucalyptus branches. I mean, these were good 2 and 3 inch across branches. And I carved them, and then I strapped leather around the joints and wet them so that it would tighten up. I knew enough about these kinds of things. I didn't want to use any electric devices to put this together. There was something primal I wanted to create that we could stand under or in front of. But I think that's something that if that were me, man, that would be something I would cherish literally the rest of my days.
And you also tapped into something very ancient, because in ancient times, when a baby was born, a tree was planted for them in many cultures. And when they get married, branches of the tree are cut down, and you create, whether in Judaism, a chuppah, or in, you know, other traditions, a tent or an element for the altar. It's used in their wedding. So you didn't even realize that you were tapping into something that goes back thousands of years.
Can you imagine that?
Pretty
if
awesome.
Well, yeah, it is. And can you imagine if we were planting a tree for every person that's been born? We'd have over 7 billion trees, new trees.
That's right. That's
and
right.
we wouldn't have an air pollution problem, I think, in a big way.
So maybe we can start a new ritual now. Every time a baby is born, someone plants a tree.
Absolutely.
Let's go for it.
Let's do it. And we're going to be planting trees until the cows come home, folks, and day and night, day and night. I think that's very cool. Let me ask you to go back a little bit, or maybe not so so short a time, but go back to the beginning, your beginnings in this regard. When did this issue of rituals and ceremony and tradition, I mean, that's what they become traditions. When did this become all-encompassing for you? Because, you know, I could sit here and say, look, you know, Barbara, I'm a working guy, and I work 9 to 5, and I work hard, and I go home and I knock back a couple of beers, watch TV, go to sleep, and get up the next day to work hard again. I don't have time for this nonsense.
See, not true, because to me, rituals can be 5 minutes or they can be hours. So, you know, one of the things I really love to do with, you know, my clients and people I work with is create short little rituals that they could put into their day so that they pepper it with more meaning. So instead of just having your ritual come home, which in a way that was his ritual, to come home and have a beer and space out, why don't you do some more self-care rituals? You know, do something where I know a couple that every night before they go to bed, their ritual is just to say, I love you. And they do something which they call, you know, cookie night on Friday, where they like to, you know, bake cookies together or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't care if you have a glass of wine together. That's fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
But to do something that has a little bit of meaning that just takes a few minutes. you know, my mother right now is in the hospital, and she's in a rehab, and she's getting better. But I have to tell you that I make sure when I go there every day that she has those self-care rituals that make her feel alive and good about herself.
Yeah.
So I make sure, like today, I made sure that they washed her hair. I made sure she had her favorite necklace with her. You know, I made sure that we bring her her favorite flowers, you know, and we're connecting, we're telling stories. That's very, very important, and it doesn't take a lot of time. It just takes a little thought. Not time, just thought.
There's another aspect that you talk about, self-care rituals. That springs to mind. And of course, this is more for men than women, but I guess women could incorporate this as well. And that has to do, for women, it would be the way in which they fix their hair. Whereas for men, in most cases, it would be the facial hair. Now, I don't know all the names of the different types of. I've heard of there's what's called the soul patch, was just a little piece of hair or a fuzz, if you will, or long hair on the chin. Mm-hmm. I thought that was called a goatee, but obviously there's another name for it. And then they call them mutton chops. And then there's the full beard mustache, which I have, although I shave my head. And I'm getting used to the idea of doing it myself. I was going to a guy who did it for me. You know, and that was fine because there was a certain level of camaraderie there. You know, and we would chat a little bit about how things were going. But for some reason, I don't know if it's because he's holding a straight razor in his hand that made me feel uncomfortable or what. But I'm learning to kind of do that myself. And maybe that's another part of that whole there is a certain element for a man of being able to do things for himself.
What else could you do for yourself? You can make sure that, you know, you get a massage, or you can, a self-care ritual is that you make yourself a special protein shake in the morning that gives you the energy you need,
mm-hmm.
or you make your working out a ritual of taking care of yourself, not just, you know, competing and having the biggest muscles. So
right.
It's a shift in consciousness, how you weave the. I know guys on Wall Street, to them, having their Wall Street, you know, journal in the morning and their cup of coffee can be a ritual of focus and connection.
Right.
Rather than just do it unconsciously. So, you know, you want to look at how can you weave those little things. Another ritual I like to do for busy people at work is make a ritual of never answering the phone on the first ring. Take a deep breath. Breathe.
Mm.
Make that your ritual of, you know, de-stressing. That's all it takes.
You clear the energy.
The first time, clear the energy,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, just simple things, but it brings a different consciousness, connection,
yeah.
And actually it gives you a lot more creative power and focus. You'll be more successful and you'll be happier.
I think that oftentimes we will be on the phone with somebody and we'll get off the phone and say, oh, they must be having a bad day. You know, because of their whatever their demeanor was on the phone with you. Whereas if they had taken that breath beforehand and cleared that energy out, it would
right.
have been a fresh conversation. No interference
Absolutely.
From the events of the hours prior to that call, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, really important to, I mean, I call them business rituals because,
yeah.
you know, business people need to hear that business word to feel comfortable. But the truth is there are certain things that if you do it, you will be more successful. And you need to just weave them in. They don't take a lot of time. They could take 6 seconds, 10 seconds. That's it.
Mm.
And then you're in a different place.
I want to talk now about something that, and I'm going to warn our listeners that it might be a little bit more personal, not for me, but just the conversation in general. And that has to do with the more, especially with couples. And it doesn't
mm-hmm.
matter. It doesn't matter the type of relationship, the more intimate types of rituals. I'm very familiar with Tantra, for example. I know that's a
right.
big. That was a big thing in the late 90s, coming into the 21st century,
right.
and it still is to some degree. But it's more. I'd have to say that is more about creating those kinds of rituals that help to not only make oneself feel better about oneself, more secure in one's own skin, but also that aspect of bonding the two or three or however many you're sharing this moment with. But that, again, that sense of community on a much more intimate level.
Well, we're talking about sacred sexuality.
Yes.
Which, again, you know, there are so many rituals of sex has gotten a bad name. You know, I mean, it started out, or my interpretation, you know, is the true meaning of sexuality is a real merging. It's a connection. It's a sharing. It's a loving, you know, and there's pleasure involved. And then it turned into something else, and then people, you know, didn't want to talk about it, or they were afraid. Or so if you really can start to do rituals around, you know, feeling your own body, a lot of people don't even have a sense of what makes them happy. It's pretty interesting. I mean, even starting out with, you know, oils or bubble baths or just touching, you know, massaging, that could be really a sacred way of sharing. And when it comes from that place, it's very different. As you know, if you study Tantra or are involved in it, it's a whole different thing.
Yes, it really is. I think that in the West in particular, we have created so many, I almost want to use the term obstacles.
Yeah,
to,
taboos.
Taboos I think is a good name, but obstacles as well, to individuals being able to cultivate the kinds of meaningful relationships that they really crave. I really believe that people mm-hmm. do crave them, even though, you know, they're even afraid of them. And again, that goes back to the issue, as you, I think the correct word you used is taboo. Can we talk a little bit about creating a new positive aspect,
yes, absolutely,
to our sexuality?
You know, and it goes back to becoming a man, becoming a woman, because all the ancient rituals of rites of passage involve the older women talking to the girls about how to, you know, really be in a real relationship, and the men talk to the men. You know, I mean, there was a real sharing of the wisdom of what it meant to be in relationship on a physical level, emotional, mental, and spiritual. And that was part of the rite of passage that we've sort of thrown out. We don't have that anymore. You know, we have a YouTube video now, or
yeah,
it's on Instagram, or but we don't have the wise men like yourself talking to the younger boys to really, you know, honoring the female body, honoring their own body, and explaining all of that. We've lost that, which is very sad to me.
We don't have the crones and the wizards anymore, as those were
no,
the two terms so that were used.
Again, we're going to bring them back. I think we're starting a movement here today.
We've got a lot of work to do. We've got to plant a bunch of trees.
We have trees and all kinds of things to do here. I'm writing down my new list.
Oh, all right. Very good. As am I. I'm putting it on the back page of your book here. And the book is entitled The Joy of Ritual. It is by Barbara Bijou, and it is spiritual recipes to celebrate milestones, ease transition, and make every day sacred. You know, here on the South Coast where I live, as we head into spring and summer and even into the fall, we have periods of days that get extremely warm. And it is next to impossible, unless you have air conditioning, to get comfortable. And we just had a couple of those days over this past weekend as we are talking here, that it's like, I'm thinking, it's not that I made a mistake moving here. It's like, what's the deal here? This is not what I ordered, kind of thing. But I find myself wanting to somehow, I don't know why, the thought has come to me that ritual and tradition can actually help us get through some of the minor as well as the major challenges in our lives. The loss of a loved one, the loss of a relationship, the loss of a job, moving to a new location. I mean, you even shared just a few moments ago about how you had this ritual that you did in terms of letting your son go, and then suddenly, boom, he's going. That I think we might want to talk a little bit about in terms of its importance to being able to move on without it's not about letting go or not letting go. It's about holding the memories. And there's a difference between not moving on and remembering, having those memories. Can we talk about that?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Well, first of all, the kind of things you're talking about, too, are, you know, to me, it's like putting the period at the end of a sentence. Doesn't mean a sentence, you can't go back and read it again, but there's an ending to that, and you're moving on to the next. So the past is precious. We want to learn from it, but we don't always want it to define the future. So there has to be a balance between really honoring the past, which we don't always do, and then opening up to something new for the future, which is why you do a ritual when you leave a house, not just when you move into a new house. So if you leave a job, if you leave a relationship, if you leave the house, there needs to be an honoring. What is the lessons? What did you get out of it? You know, what was the things that worked or didn't work? And traditionally, especially if it's a home, you want to honor the land. You want to honor the land that you've been living on because you're co-creating, you know, with the earth. And so that just puts a different spin on it. And then you set your intention, which we all know now, the whole idea of intentionality really is the new science of the 21st century, that you set intention for what you want to bring into your relationship, what you want your work to be about, what you want your friendships to be about, your health. So then those rituals set that intention, which gives you a focus so that you get pulled into the future. You're not chugging along like a boulder up a rock, up a mountain. Mm-hmm. You're pulled up. It gives you a different energy. And that's why so many of these things are so crucial. Even you're having a bad day at work. You know, you get an email that makes you crazy. So print out the email. Don't answer it. And then do a ritual where you're letting it go, rip it up, shred it. You know, if you're at home, safely burn it. And I say safely because that's really important.
Yeah.
You know, so that you stop that and then you refocus. You've had that breath, you've had that pause, and you have more space.
We seem to be in a world today that demands that we do things quick, now. Answer that, reply. I'll be honest with you, even as I'm doing some of these interviews, I will pop over just in case I'm getting an email from someone and I get a few over there and I think, oh, I need to reply to this right now. And it's like, no, you don't. And it's not that they're bad emails or that they've elicited some kind of negative reaction from me. It's more, you're in the middle of doing...
It pulls your focus.
Yeah, it pulls your
focus.
And I remember I heard about a study that came out last year regarding multitasking. They did a study regarding both the young and the old as far as multitasking. What they found was that, yes, it is true, we can multitask. But what they were measuring wasn't the ability to multitask. They were measuring the quality of the productivity of those individuals who were multitasking. And the quality diminished significantly. I mean, we're talking down into single digits.
Mm-hmm.
And so
not only is the quality, but people's IQs are going down. The London School did, I believe it was the University of London, I'd have to look it up, did a research project recently. And there was even something in the New York Times in the last few days, how people's IQs are going down now by trying to multitask. It just doesn't really work. It's making people stupid.
Yeah, we weren't designed. I mean, some people say, oh, no, we can do it. That doesn't necessarily, just because you can drive your car up a wall doesn't mean it was designed to, you know. Or I love the phrase, which I think is perfectly appropriate. Just because we can, does that mean we should or we have to?
Right.
I actually put that in the context of even flying. I realize that we've been flying for over 100 years since the Wright brothers, but does that necessarily mean we should be? And consider the realities of the spread of disease. Just as one small little piece of that. Look what happens when we have a disease that is an outbreak in one part of the world that people are visiting, and then they carry that virus or that bacteria onto the plane, which is nothing more than a petri dish in the sky, and we land it, and then those people spread out, and they get onto another flight, and I mean, think about that. I mean, what other? There's no other species that spreads their contaminants like humans.
Right, and there's no other species that doesn't stop and rest.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that I love about ritual, and I talk about it a lot in my blog and on different videos that I do, that we need to have that quiet. Otherwise, it's like your life is a constant talk button, and you're never pressing that listen button. So you might ask for things, you might be chatting away, but you never really get to restore, and you never really get to plug into your own inner wisdom. You miss it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We do need, that's what the rituals of Sabbath are about, and I don't care what religion you are, you need a day off, you need a break where you're not working, and it's like become a thing of the past now. What do you mean, don't work? You know, it's like, you ask people, how are you? They go, busy, and you go, oh yeah, no one even questions it anymore. It's very sad, so we need to bring back some of those rituals where we stop, even if you're saying an hour. You need to have time off. You really do.
I know that on Saturdays and Sundays, when we're lying in bed in the middle of the afternoon watching TV.
Oh, nice. Good for you.
You know, sometimes we sit there and we'll make the comment to each other, it's going to be one of those lazy Sundays, which Sundays are great to be lazy. But it's like, and then, of course, we reiterate to each other, yeah, well, you know, we both work very hard during the week and so forth and so on. And so we don't get around to maybe cleaning the house or getting the dishes out of the sink or whatever the case might be.
Who cares?
But we do take care of the animals every morning. I mean, like clockwork. But nonetheless, it's like we've decided that we're not going to feel guilty anymore for taking and just kind of quote unquote blowing off a Sunday and not doing anything. You know,
how
and,
fabulous.
You know,
congratulations.
And, yeah. I guess
really,
I'm in the,
I think that's great.
I'm in the right industry, I guess.
Yes,
but,
you are.
I think that it helps my high blood pressure. That was another interesting thing, too. Unless maybe we'll talk a little bit about health and wellness and medicine. I was I had about 3.5 years ago. It was like in November, and all of a sudden I was having I was getting angry for no apparent reason as far as driving. And I've been driving since I was 38. I'm 52, 53 now. And I thought, where is this coming from? And of course, about a year later, you know, feeling a little lightheaded and this and that and the other. So I'd go in and they say, oh, they check my blood pressure. And I mean, we're talking about pressure up around 184 over 110. And my wife is saying, oh, this is in stroke zone. And now she works in cardiology and so forth. So she knows this stuff. And of course, they ran every test. I kid you not. They drew blood and they did this and they did that. And I peed in a cup and on and on and on. They found nothing. And I said, you're not going to find anything because it's not biological. It's mental. It's emotional. I'm not doing well with the outside world right now. And I wasn't really sure why. I think that that's changed considerably, in the, especially with our animals. And I believe, genuinely believe, as do the studies bear out, that animals in one's life will vastly improve an individual's health.
Absolutely. They bring them into old age homes now. They are using them with the Wounded Warrior projects for, you know, people coming back from the wars. There's a whole school of using horses now with children who are in trauma, dolphins. Absolutely. It's very grounding for them, and it's very useful.
Yeah. Well, let's talk
about unconditional love.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's talk about the rituals. And actually, when you have animals in your home, we had chickens, we have dogs, we have cats. And our ritual in the morning when we get up about 6:30, literally every morning, because now the dogs are set to that clock, we start feeding the animals. And that's our ritual of caring for them as they have cared for us.
Caring for them.
Yeah.
And even people in cities who walk their dogs make it a ritual of connection.
Yeah.
Connecting with your animal, connecting with outside, with the earth. So you can almost be doing a walking meditation or a running meditation while you're playing with your animal and connecting. Again, it's a consciousness as opposed to you're half asleep and you don't notice what's going on.
Yeah.
It will change everything to start your day like that.
And if someone doesn't have an animal in their lives, I highly recommend it. Find the right one for you. Don't just go out, and buy.
Right. And if you can't, go visit one.
Yeah,
you know,
visit one.
Visit your friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Make that your ritual. Once a week, you visit an animal someplace.
Find a petting zoo.
Right.
Or what have you. I think that's great advice. When we want to create a ritual for a particular event, a milestone, if you will, a transition point.
Right.
For some people, for those who have never thought of it in this context, as we've been describing, how would you guide them in the first and second and third steps, if you will, to creating a ritual?
So step number one, what's your intention? You know, is it to celebrate a wedding, an anniversary, you know, friendship? So make sure you're clear on that. Then if you're going to do it with a group, you want to include elements that people all can relate to and understand. So I always go with nature because no one gets offended versus some people bring in a lot of religious symbolism that some people don't relate to, and then it kind of skews it. So, you know, bring in flowers, bring in, you know, if you're at the beach, you could do something. And then very simply, as much as possible, engage your senses. So it needs a beginning and an ending. So number one, you could start by just taking a deep breath, holding hands, turning a candle, you know, lighting a candle, turning off something. So it has that beginning. You can play music if you want. Make it very simple is better when you're starting if you've never done this. So, for example, I'll give you a ritual that a five-year-old did, okay? Never did a ritual in his life, decided he wanted to celebrate his father's birthday, and he had never met his father. His father had died while he was being born. So he never actually met him. And he invited his aunts. Remember, this kid is five. Invite his aunts and his mother to participate in the ritual. He got himself all dressed up in his favorite baseball cap and his favorite shirt, and he brought all his things that he loved, like his toy car and a picture he did, and he asked his aunts to light a candle because he wasn't old enough, and he said that in order to remember his father, he wanted everybody to share something about his father that he didn't know. So he asked his aunts and his mother to share something with him. And then at the end, he said he wanted his dad to be proud of him, so he wanted his dad to see the pictures he drew and what he brought out his baseball cards. And that was it. And they did this ritual for 15 years. Until he went off to college. Every year he did it slightly different. One year he asked people to bring his father's favorite junk food because he wanted to know. So the bottom line, if a five-year-old can do it, you can do it too. There's no right or wrong as long as you're not hurting anyone. And just go it from your heart, you know? Go from your heart.
Yeah, that's cool. That is really very cool. I love that. Again, as you say, from a five-year-old.
From a five-year-old. This is not an adult who looked up something, you know, to find out the right way to do it. He just knew he wanted to connect to his dad. His dad wasn't alive, so his aunts and mother were. And to him, his dad could hear him if he talked, because he really believed that. And he wasn't even religious, by the way. He was not brought up religious. So it's not that he had a huge ritual background or anything. He did not, which was why everyone was so surprised when he wanted to do this. You know, I've seen people just have a ritual of storytelling or, like you said, making something. It could be drawing a picture, you know, finding a rock at the beach or, you know, in the mountains and painting a rock and giving it to someone and saying, I love you. You know, a touchstone. It doesn't have to be fancy. It really doesn't. And then at the end, you want to know that it's over. So, again, you blow out the candle, you turn off the music, you just hold hands, you say it's done. Just like for a wedding, you go, you know, I now pronounce you husband and wife. You know, there's something that ends it. It's important. So you contain the energy.
I think that's great. I really do. And I can't reiterate enough how important these are. We, for the longest time in our home back in Phoenix, we had a, I would consider it permanent, altar that we set up in a room, and we put important things there. We put crystals. We put pictures of people that we knew. I have to say that, as a matter of fact, this brings to mind an event that happened with a dear friend who passed away in our home before we left Phoenix. And we had an altar set up in one of the bedrooms, and he was actually living with us at the time. And we had been to Ireland, and we were planning on going back again, and we called the bed and breakfast that we stayed at. We became very good friends with the family there. We haven't heard from them recently, but this was going back to 2002, 2003. And when we called, we found out that the wife had passed away. And of course, I'm talking to the husband, and he's very sad, obviously, and of course, telling me about the wake. And I thought this was so profound that, and a wake is a wonderful, wonderful ritual in and of itself. There were the town that she lived, they lived in, was only about 1,200 people. And it seemed as though all 1,200 had shown up. And I remember this significantly because when we were there the first time, she was going to a funeral almost every day because she knew everybody there. And I remember our dear friend who was there with us at the time of this phone call, you know, we're sitting there on the chair very sadly, and he goes into the room, and we had a picture of the two of them, the husband and wife, on the altar. And he comes back out in tears. I was like, wow, this guy doesn't even know these people. And he's moved by her passing. And he says to us that, I hope the grieving process is short. And we all hugged. And obviously tears flowed and so forth. But that, to me, that was, it was as if he had been called to facilitate our grieving in a ritualistic sense. It was like he became sort of that, and I didn't see it then, but I do now. He became that high priest, if you will, to guide us through those moments in particular. And then, of course,
You were lucky. You were very blessed that he could do that, you know. And as you said, he came in, he took that role, and, you know, I often say, you know, right now, to me, ritual is the spiritual technology, and it's really, you know, in ancient times, people did it because it worked. Now people are starting to understand what it does to your brain and how it really affects you and connects you. So, you know, whether you're just taking this on faith or you want to really understand why it works, it's very powerful.
Yeah.
And it can change everything. Just that one moment, you were very blessed.
Before we go, let me ask you, who is Barbara Bijou?
Mother, priestess, teacher, adventurer, explorer, you know. All of that. And hopefully the outer keeps getting transformed and reinvented and wiser as I get older. All of it. I've had 5 careers in my life. I've traveled around the world. I've done a lot of wonderful things, and I still plan on doing it.
And I ask this question very respectfully that, one day, if you have not achieved it yet, one day, would you like to be the crone of the tribe?
Would I like to be the crone of the tribe? So it's a very good question. Yes, and I also think we need a new word.
Okay.
I'm not sure what it is yet, but yes. You know, there is still something about crone in the true meaning is beautiful and wonderful and wise and fabulous. The way it's used in our society is not.
Is not.
So I'd like to be kind of a sexy, vibrant crone.
There you go.
You know?
We'll go with that. Another aspect of the work.
You like that one?
Another aspect of the work that we need to be doing is changing the energetics of some of these words. Exactly. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing?
For me, it's really inspiring and empowering people and connecting. I'm a connector, and I love to be able to connect people to each other, to spirit, to the earth, and just through all those connections, hopefully add my part to the evolution of, you know, the planet and the earth and where and our species and where we are. And part of it is through respecting other cultures and understanding, you know, where some of these spiritual practices come from and why they are so important to people, having a respect for them.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
Incredibly powerful. I feel we are very powerful, and we also can't control everything. So it's either and, not either or.
And I would venture that rituals play a very, very large part in that power that we have.
So again, we get to plug in. And I think, you know, that's really important. And we get to plug in and also crack open that jewel that's inside our heart, inside of our being, which is spirit.
Barbara Beeger has been my guest, and her book, The Joy of Ritual, is available through your website. And your website is?
BarbaraBeeger.com. That's B-I-Z as in zebra, I-O-U.com. And I have lots of free stuff. And if anyone wants to sign up for my free Ritual of the Month newsletter, they will get a free 30-day workbook as a gift from me.
I find it interesting, too, as you're an interfaith minister, and as we've talked throughout the program, I mean, the rituals and tradition abound through the eons of time when it comes to man's search for his meaning in the world and the universe and search for that higher power and so forth.
Yes. Yeah. And when I do, you know, ceremonies, I like to weave that all in because, you know, people are all coming from different places, so they have different needs. Again, I keep going back to your wedding ceremony. You know, it needs to be personal. It needs to be meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember my first wedding, and I was only 23 at the time, so I was still very young, but I remember kind of just being swept along. You know, I didn't have much say. I was reprimanded a couple of times by my father-in-law for being too energetic and this and that and the other. And I didn't really feel at times like I really belonged, you know. I mean, I was the one getting married too, but it was more for the female. That ritual seems to be more for the female as opposed to
the... It was. Yeah. Not anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
it's nice. More equal now.
It's nice that it's shifting and changing. Barbara Beeger, thank you again so much for joining us on the program. Thank you for being
with us
and sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
I'll let you know
that. Have a wonderful day.
You do the same, and I'll let you know that there is an after view of this program. So if you're tuning into the radio program or the A to Zen FM program, there is an after view. Go to RichardDugan.com, the radio show page, and listen to the full interview. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.